calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome to the program on this beautiful Monday all across the United States of America. All of us who are concerned, our quote for the day from Albert Einstein, all of us who are concerned for peace and triumph of reason and justice must be keenly aware how small an influence reason and honest goodwill exert upon influence, upon events in the political field. Coming up, by the way, on today's program, Paul Craig Roberts, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, former editor on the Wall Street Journal, is going to be here asking whether Americans are gullible. And Alec Dubrow with the ILCA will be dropping by asking the question, should some members of Congress be in prison right now for violating the Fair Labor Standards Act? First, however, Frank Gaffney is with us. He is the founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., author of War Footing, 10 Steps America Must Take to Prevail in the War on the Free World, a website, Center for FOR Security Policy. org. Frank Gaffney, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you for having me. It's nice to be with you.
I'm looking at your website here, Frank, Center for Security Policy, and in fact, I've spent a fair amount of time with it this morning, and it seems to me in some ways I'm getting deja vu, like I've seen this movie before. Back in the 70s, when Rumsfeld and Cheney put together the Committee on the Present Danger, to warn us about how the Soviet Union had secret weapons of mass destruction that we knew nothing about. And the CIA said, no, they don't. And Rumsfeld said, yes, they do. And it turned out, ultimately, that the CIA was right and Rumsfeld was wrong. But why? I mean, you're really into this whole Islamo-fascism thing. Do you really think, Frank Gaffney, that if we weren't in the Middle East pumping oil, that Osama bin Laden would give a hoot about us at all?
Well, I think if you listen to what he says, the answer has to be yes. He and others who adhere to what I think is best described as a totalitarian political ideology, I think it's accurately described as Islamofascism, aspire to world domination. They believe that it is God's will that they will triumph and impose their form of Islam, which I think is really mostly about power, really, rather than faith, over not only all Muslims the world over, but also all non-Muslims. This is central to what they say to themselves. It is central to what they broadcast to the world. And I think we ignore it at our peril.
Well, I have a book at home called Messages to the World, the Speeches of Osama bin Laden, and they've been compiled, all of his videos, all of his writings, everything's about 250 pages long. I've read most of it, and I've never encountered bin Laden saying that. I remember very clearly bin Laden saying back in the 90s that he felt that the placement of U.S. soldiers at bin Salman Air Force Base in Saudi Arabia was a defiling of the Holy Land, and that he was going to attack the United States, his declaration in 1996, that he was going to attack the United States if we didn't remove those soldiers who Bush Sr. put there in 91 as staging against Kuwait, and if we didn't raise the price of oil up to at least $70 a barrel because we were raping the natural resources of the Holy Land, of Saudi Arabia. I mean, have you actually read bin Laden's writings, Frank?
Yeah, I confess that, like you, I probably haven't read all of them, but I certainly am familiar with the thrust of, I think, what he has been saying.
Well, can you give me a quote where he says that he wants to take over the United States? Because I haven't been able to find anything like that. In fact, everything I'm finding is the opposite. He's basically saying, get out of our business.
Yeah. Well, Tom, I think if you look at what he has said subsequent to 96, you'll see changing war aims. He was never mentioning Israel until fairly recently. He was never mentioning the plight of the Palestinian people until fairly recently.
Well, he's a political opportunist.
What you see? Well, I'm suggesting to you that he is a man who has great ambitions, and they are not exclusively a function of whether we are in the Middle East or not, which was the opening question. I believe, if you, more to the point, if you look at this movement more broadly, and I believe bin Laden is one manifestation of it, not something that we can safely be solely preoccupied with. If you look at this Islamofascist movement, Shiite and Sunni worldwide, the evidence of the hatred for America that has nothing to do with our presence in the Middle East and everything to do with the fact that we are an infidel nation that subscribes to tenets of democracy that the Islam.
But so is Sweden. They're not attacking Sweden. In fact, if anything, Sweden is more liberal than we are.
You're up against, I think. I honestly believe. You ignore that again.
But Frank, Sweden is even more liberal than we are, and they're not attacking Sweden. Sweden is not pumping their oil.
I think if you look at the face of Europe today, you have Swedish women who are being raped on a regular basis by Islamists who believe they're not women. You look at Denmark,
what?
The Scandinavian country, and it is in the throes of a major contest over whether it is going to remain a liberal democracy. You look at France, you look at Italy, you look at Germany, you look at Britain. All of these countries are in the crosshairs of the Islamofascists, and so are we.
Come on, Frank. I've been in at least half those countries in the last...
Look at Tom, look at France's policies towards the Middle East. You could hardly find...
Which are the result, you know, I mean, France's problems have to do with the fact that they had colonized part of Africa, and they have, you know, all these folks who were the former subjects of their rule now living in France and not assimilating particularly well, and they're messing the whole thing up. I mean, the French are messing the whole thing up. But before, you know, without getting into the minutiae of this, I would like to just challenge your use of the word fascist. This baffles me. Benito Mussolini invented that word. And, you know, he based it on the fasce, the Latin word for the bundle of sticks with an axe sticking out of the top of it and a rope around it, which was the symbol of the old Roman Empire. And the theory was that a bundle of sticks doesn't break as easily as a single stick. And Mussolini suspended Parliament, dissolved Parliament, and replaced each one of the parliamentary districts around Italy. Instead of electing a representative to go to Parliament, the largest corporation in that district sent a representative to be represented in Parliament. And his definition of fascism was the merging of corporate and state interests. And Franco in Spain picked that up. Hitler in Germany picked that up, although I would say Hitler went way beyond fascism and became a psychotic maniac, fill in the blanks, as expletive as you want to get. But fascism is a very specific political system that merges government and corporate interests in a way that is more consistent with Tom DeLay. What these guys are theocrats. They are looking for a government run based on a revealed religion. Is that not correct, Frank Gaffney?
I wouldn't say so, no. I think that what fascism has come to be known as is a political process in which you not only have the merger of the state with corporate interests, but you also have the domination of all aspects of life by a repressive totalitarian regime. And it comes under different flavors. I freely grant you, you could call this communism with a god, you could call it national socialism if you wish. But the thing that these...
I'd say it's a theocracy. I mean, what's wrong with calling it theocracy?
Let me just describe it, because it's different, I think, than theocracy. Because it is not just about faith. It is about creating the instruments of power and controlling the instruments of power in very much the same way that these other totalitarians have.
Well, I mean, look at the Inquisition in the 1400s, the 1500s in Spain.
If I may answer your question, I believe that if you focus narrowly on the fact that these guys are justifying their form of repressive totalitarianism with religion, you miss the point. And more to the point, you play into the hands of those who...
I think that is the point.
Anytime you talk about these guys as people who have some connection to religion, you play into the hands of those like the Council on American Islamic Relations who insist that everybody who says that are racist and bigots against all Muslims. I'm making a distinction between the vast majority of Muslims who I don't believe want to be ruled by the Taliban-style fascists and those who are clearly part of this movement. And that's why I think there's an important distinction here.
Well, and it... At every level, these guys use religion. They invoke religion. They're following religion. Are you reluctant to use the word theocrat because of the strong theocratic tendencies of the current Republican Party?
No, to the contrary. I'm happy using the word theocrat, too. I'm just saying that I think that the theocracy is basically a patina on a totalitarian political ideology. And you can call it that if you want to. I prefer to use something that I think speaks directly to the political phenomenon, because I think that's what tells us what we have to do about these guys. We're not going to wage war on the Muslim faith as a faith. I believe what we have to do if we want to address the problem is wage an ideological war on the ideology that is underpinning this movement at the moment.
Frank, can you stick around?
Sure.
I'd like to continue this conversation after the break, because I'd like to challenge that, if I may. It's 16 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Frank Gaffney. He's with the Center for Security Policy, centerforsecuritypolicy.org, the website. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Frank Gaffney's with us. He's with the Center for Security Policy, centerforsecuritypolicy.org, their website. Would you describe yourself as a neoconservative group, Frank?
I don't know what it means, to be honest with you. People have said that, but they never issued me a party card.
Okay.
To be honest with you, I find it usually used as a euphemism in a pretty pejorative way to say Jews when you don't want to say it, and I'm not. So.
That's certainly not how I would use it, but in any case, you are promoters of the idea of war with what you call Islamofascism. Is that an accurate description?
No, actually, what we're saying is that the Islamofascists have declared war on us. We're arguing that we can't afford to pretend otherwise.
Let me toss a couple of frames out here at you.
Can I just finish that point, Tom? Because it's really important. I would just say that there are lots of ways that you can counter an ideology without having to go to war the old-fashioned way. And our strong preference is to use those tools, much as Ronald Reagan did, against the ideology of Soviet communism, which enabled us to defeat them without actually going to war with them.
Well, this is the point that I was going to make, and that is the world, on the day after 9/11, you had candlelight vigil in downtown Tehran, Iran, on behalf of the United States. We had the Islamic world on our side. They were looking at what was done in the name of radical Islam, and they were just as horrified as Christians across America were horrified when Tim McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City, the federal building in Oklahoma City, believing, he read the Turner Diaries, that it was going to cause Christians around the country to rise up against a repressive government. He thought that the Clinton administration would overreact and do away with civil liberties in the United States, and that would cause all the good white people with guns to come out in the streets and reclaim America for the good white Christians. He was wrong. Clinton didn't respond to it as if it was a war. He responded to him like he was a criminal. And I would suggest that by Bush responding to the 9/11 event the way he did and in invading Iraq and occupying an Arab country, he has created far more terrorists than we have prevented, which is very good for big business and for the defense industry. And I would submit to you that these folks don't hate us; they hate our foreign policies.
Yeah, well, we have a fundamental
difference in worldview here.
Take a look, if you could, if you haven't already, at a film called Obsession, Radical Islam's War Against the West, which is available. You can take a look at least at obsessionthemovie.com. It presents, I think, in indisputable form, the words of the people I'm talking about who are inciting Arabs and Persians and others around the world alike to jihad in the name of Islam.
But we are feeding that obsession.
It doesn't have to do with our foreign policy. By and large, what these guys are complaining about is we happen to believe things they don't. We happen to protect things they don't, like women. We happen to believe that they are capable of contributing to society, which is something that the Islamofascists don't. I mean, these are
but it's something that the Baathists do, and yet we attacked Iraq.
If you ignore them again, Tom, I believe you're going to miss the whole point.
I'm not. I would never suggest ignoring these guys. I would marginalize them. I would criminalize them. I would have taken Bin Laden. I would have been, you know, if I was running the show, Bin Laden would have been in jail 5 years ago. I mean, when the Taliban offered to hand Bin Laden over to the Western world, we should have taken him.
Well, listen, what you said a moment ago, if I understood you, was that you would not have done what George W. Bush did right after 9/11, which was get ready to go to find Bin Laden and take him out to the extent he could, and if he couldn't, to take down the support system, the Islamofascist regime the Taliban ran in Afghanistan that gave him safe haven and the ability to operate against us.
I think that Bush's response to 9/11 was a response of hysteria. His response was a response of hysteria. It was like, oh, my God, we've been attacked. We've got to go to war. And instead of saying, as Bill Clinton did when Tim McVeigh did essentially the same thing with the Oklahoma City bombing, we've got a crazy guy here who, in the name of religion, is attacking us, and we're going to deal with him like the criminal that he is.
Yeah.
And I think that you guys are promoting this thing that is actually feeding the other side.
Yeah, fortunately, most Americans, I think, recognize that the Bin Laden operation was, both in terms of scale and in terms of its future lethality, considerably different than Timothy McVeigh. I have to tell you, I
don't disagree with that.
The way Clinton handled the Timothy McVeigh matter, but I will be honest with you, if you think for a moment that we could have simply proceeded in a sort of law enforcement mode against Bin Laden, I would suggest you, not only wouldn't you have captured him, but you would have been subjected, we as a people would have been subjected to even worse than...
It worked against it. This is the traditional way that governments have dealt with terrorism, whether it was the Bader-Meinhof gang, whether it was the IRA, whether it was the Basque separatists. And these are groups who are grounded in ideology, in religion, in racial differences, in ethnic differences. Right across the board, you consistently say they're criminals.
Yeah, but listen, this is a different breed of cat. You're dealing with people who enjoy state sponsorship, who are explicitly the vanguard of an ideological movement that is supported by very wealthy states.
We're going to have to leave it there. Frank Gaffney, the Center for SecurityPolicy.org. If you want to learn all about their worldview, check it out. Frank, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
On September 12th, we had the world on our side. But George Bush, he started to divide. He cut off the UN and our allies too. And now he wants to drive a wedge between me and you. But fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great.
Now, but there's some big bucks to be made peddling fear, I'll tell you, and there's some incredible political gain to be acquired by peddling fear. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, their telephone number, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com, their website for the latest iPods and Macintoshes and all things Macintosh and iPod and all that kind of thing. Welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, and Steve in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just had to make a comment about your guest that you just had on. A few years ago, I was watching C-SPAN, and Frank Gaffney was a guest on some talk show, and he said something which... just absolutely blew me away. He said within about I can't remember the exact dates, but he predicted that he believed that there was a 10% chance of armed conflict with China within 5 years, a 30% chance of conflict with China in 10 years, the numbers went up, and if I remember right, within about 20 years, Mr. Gaffney said 100% likelihood the U.S. would be at war with China within about 20 years. And I would just like to know if Mr. Gaffney still believes that. 100% means that he is absolutely positive that we will be at war within China within that time frame.
Yeah. Well, I can't speak for him. I'm looking at his website, Center for Security Policy,
mm-hmm.
and I just Googled the word China on that site, and I see, you know, these are just little fragments of pieces. At this point in our history, do we really need a Treasury Secretary who is a pedigreed friend of China? One website says it represents only the only second opinion. I don't know. But I can tell you, there are folks out there who really think that the best way to deal with any problem is war. I'm not saying that Frank Gaffney or the center, you know, are about that. But there are folks who, and frankly, I think that George W. Bush believes that the way that the world, you're either good or bad, right? And if you're bad, you should be killed. I mean, it just really boils right down to that.
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
Right? It's very simple in his worldview. And when he was governor of Texas, he killed a whole bunch of evil people, and he was quite pleased with that. And that makes the world safer in his mind. And now he sees evil people in other countries, and he has no problem killing them. And I'm sorry. Yes, I acknowledge evil. And I know that when we kill people, they have cousins and nephews and aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and children, and those people end up hating us. I mean, it's just, you know, we've killed 100,000 civilians in Iraq, at least, according to, you know, some pretty reasonable estimates. And what, we think we're making friends? I mean, just look at what's going on there. It doesn't seem to be working. So in terms of conflict with China, Steve, I don't know, but just in terms of conflict in general, we really need to be, in my opinion, going back to more of an Eisenhower worldview.
Yeah.
Rather than Bush is unique. I don't think that we have had he's McKinley. McKinley was the last president of the United States, 1796, I think Kinley was elected, maybe it was 94.
Mm-hmm.
McKinley was the last president who started a foreign war for political purposes and thought it was a good idea. He started the Spanish-American War, and he did so because his political advisor, Mark Hanna, told him it would help him win the next election. And sure enough, it did. And he did so because the friend of industrialists and big newspaper guy, William Randolph Hearst, told him that it would help sell papers. He says, you start a war and I'll deliver the publicity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this unholy alliance, and everybody made a whole bunch of money, and McKinley got his reelection. He died, I believe was he assassinated or a heart attack? In any case, he died shortly after, in his second term, which is what caused Teddy Roosevelt, who was vice president, to become president, and then things didn't work out quite the way that McKinley thought. But I think they're probably the only two presidents in the history of this country. You could argue that John Adams tried to whip up a war with France, but I don't think he really wanted it. He just wanted the rhetoric for it.
Mm-hmm.
Who have done this. And we need to go back to the foreign policies of people like James Madison and Dwight Eisenhower and say, let's have a rational foreign policy. Go ahead.
Can I make a prediction?
Yeah.
Like I said, if you ever have Mr. Gaffney back on again, ask if he still believes that. But as far as China, is it 2008 that we're supposed to have the Olympics in China?
I don't know. I know it's. I thought it was a little farther out than that, like 2010, but I just don't know.
I will never forget when we boycotted the Olympics in, I believe, 1984. Was it 80 or 84 when we boycotted the Olympics?
I don't recall.
Okay.
It was when Jimmy Carter was president, so probably would have been.
Oh, that's right. It was Afghanistan. That's why we boycotted. But
yeah.
I predict that when the Olympics happen, we will find some excuse to boycott those Olympics. I don't know what the excuse is going to be, but there will be some reason.
I doubt it. This administration is sucking up to China so much because there are so many business interests that are making money in China.
Perhaps you're right.
So, they throw people in prison. We go, it's like that woman who stood up on the White House lawn and started yelling at President Hu.
Yes.
When he was there. She was talking about the fact that they go into their prisons, that wealthy people in China or wealthy people from around the world go to China and they say, I need a kidney. They look through their prison population to find somebody who has a genetic match as a kidney donor and sentence them to death, take them out, shoot them, and extract their kidneys. I mean, this is an active business that's going on in China right now. She was a physician from China protesting that. And that part of the story didn't even get reported on American television. I mean, it was NPR reported, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the McNeil-Lehrer report, or whatever it is, the Lehrer News Hour now, reported it. But I didn't see it on any of the network news. It's like Americans just don't even know about this stuff. And I think that they don't know about it because this is where the business interests lie with the United States. Steve, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. We just can't, we cannot go on like this. This is a trifecta that just is unconscionable. One, the continuing war based on lies and continuing lies. The tremendous disparity of incomes that you've talked about so often, and I wholeheartedly agree with, and the poison, the venom spilled over by the religious right, not of talking too much but politics and religion since 1980. And then between 1980, and I'll close here, between 1980, and 2004, real wages in manufacturing fell 1%. While the real income of the richest 1% rose more than 135%.
Yeah, you're quoting from
Paul Krugman. Yes,
Paul Krugman's piece in the Friday New York Times. Yeah.
Yes, and that is one big. And this just goes to my gut feelings for all these years that there's a direct correlation between too much wealth in America.
Yeah,
there's a
yeah.
correlation there.
Well, you could. I wouldn't say that it's too much wealth. I would say that it is policies that favor the concentration of wealth and power.
But how do you separate the two?
Historically, I mean, you look at the policies under Eisenhower, you look at the policies under Roosevelt, they did not favor the concentration of wealth and power.
Right,
and
I agree.
And the policies now do, and it's just that simple. Gary, thanks a lot for the call.
That's a good compromise, Eisenhower's philosophy.
Yeah, yeah. And you go back to Krugman's article, and he points that out. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Tom in Greenville, North Carolina. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, I could see how one can argue with Iraq, but I can't see the argument for Afghanistan that there should be a law enforcement role versus the military, considering if you can't get hold of the terrorists and arrest them, and you got a Taliban regime there that won't turn him over, what can we do?
Well, Tom, they were willing to turn him over.
That's news to, I think, a lot of people. I don't think there
was... I learned about it watching the CBS Evening News. The Taliban said that they would turn bin Laden over to anybody except the United States because they didn't think he'd get a fair trial here. And so if some third country wanted to step forward and take him, they were willing to arrest him and offer him if there was any evidence that he was involved with 9/11.
Well, that's...
This is not news. I mean, this is not a secret, excuse me. This is common knowledge.
Well, that's quite different if you're correct, which I have no reason to doubt you. If there was a third country there that we could trust, I mean, let's not, talk about Syria or Iran or Libya.
No, take him to France, for trial or something. But the fact of the matter is that George Bush said, no, we're not going to allow anybody to take him. The bombing starts in 5 minutes. Essentially, to paraphrase Ronald Reagan's old joke. Bush wanted to have a war. I mean, he's a warrior. He always wanted to be a warrior. He didn't want to be in the Vietnam War. he hit out during the Vietnam War. But he gets it that there's incredible power that comes along with being a president during wartime. There's, as James Madison identified, we have to be very careful of this because war intensifies the power of the executive branch. And Bush got that, and he wanted a war. I don't think that we should have invaded Afghanistan. I know it's very fashionable right now to say, gee, we should have invaded Afghanistan. Well, what have we got for it? You've got a very unstable country right now that just produced the largest quantity of heroin in the history of the world. The Taliban, at least, wasn't even producing any heroin. They were suppressing it. I mean, that's why Bush gave them $40 million in March of 2001. Tom, thanks for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it worse. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed? Who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. I am reading from the Washington Post, Monday, October 29th, 2001, page 1. October 29th, keep in mind this is after September 11th, this is a month and a half after 9/11, October 29th, 2001, the Washington Post, the headlines, diplomats met with Taliban on bin Laden, some contend U.S. missed its chance. It's the article is written by David Ottaway and Joe Stevens. Over 3 years and on as many continents, U.S. officials met in public and secret at least 20 times with Taliban representatives to discuss ways the regime could bring suspected terrorist Osama bin Laden to justice. Talks continued until just days before the September 11 attacks, and Taliban representatives repeatedly suggested they would hand over bin Laden if their conditions were met, sources close to the discussion said. Throughout the years, however, State Department officials refused to soften their demand that bin Laden face trial in the U.S. justice system. It also remained murky whether the Taliban envoys, representing at least one division of the fractious Islamic movement, could actually deliver on their promises. The exchanges lie at the heart of a long and largely untold history of diplomatic efforts between the State Department and Afghanistan's ruling regime that paralleled covert CIA actions to take bin Laden. In the end, both diplomatic and covert actions proved fruitless. In interviews, U.S. participants and sources close to the Taliban discussed the exchanges in detail and debated whether the State Department should have been more flexible in its hardline stance. Earlier this month, this is October, this is after 9/11, October of 2001, I'm reading from the Washington Post, earlier this month, President Bush summarily rejected another Taliban offer to give up bin Laden to a neutral third country. Quote, "We know he's guilty, turn him over," end quote, Bush said. Some Afghan experts argue, continuing to read the article from the Washington Post, some Afghan experts argue that throughout the negotiations, the United States never recognized the Taliban need for ABRO, the Pashto word for face-saving formula. Officials never found a way to ease the Taliban's fear of embarrassment if it turned over a fellow Muslim to an infidel Western power. And then they go, you know, the article goes on at some length about how badly we botched the diplomacy here. But this was in October. After 9/11, the Taliban said, we will turn bin Laden over to anybody but the United States. And Bush said, no. We're going to drop bombs on you. Sorry. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. John in Skagit Valley, Washington. Hey, John, you disagree with me. You go to the front of the line. What's up?
Well, I disagree with you on the idea that the fundamentalist end of the Islamic movement that is leading Al-Qaeda is not fascist. It basically comes down to an interpretation of the Quran that suggests that eventually the whole world inevitably will be under Islam, which will be the law and the faith. And everyone will come under it, and the whole you mentioned.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with that. You know, Christianity has the same strain in it. Revealed religions do. I'm not disagreeing with that. What I'm disagreeing with is the use of the word fascist, because the word fascist has a very specific meaning. It was invented by Mussolini to mean the merging of corporate and state interests.
Right.
And in my opinion, go ahead.
But Tom, the Islam is the merging of corporate and state interests.
No, it's the merging of religion and state interests.
Yeah, but it's a religion.
That's called theocracy.
I realize what it's called, but what it is, according to their interpretation, then, is theofascist, then, because what we have.
No, they're theocrats.
What we have here are two dueling, basically, in my opinion. We have a corporate fascist bunch that are playing off of a theofascist bunch, and they're both gaining strength from this. and basically taking over our world. I mean, which Islamo-fascist is it that George Bush is going to go after? The ones he holds hands with in Crawford, Texas, or the ones he was going to give control of our ports to?
Right. I mean, yeah, there you go. But see, again, I would take the word fascist out of the equation. I really think that we need to use that word correctly, which is the merging of corporate and state interests. And I think that's the reason why these guys don't want this word used in its correct form, because they are fascists.
Well, I'll agree with you on that, Tom, but on what these fundamentalists and their interpretation of the Quran, it's basically that it comes down to the same thing, because Islam is going to be in control of the government and the corporations.
Yeah. Well, okay. We'll
yeah. I appreciate your time, Tom.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, John. We'll just leave it at that. Peter in Allentown, Pennsylvania. We got about a minute left, Peter. What's up?
Hey there. I think it's just a little bit picking over the word. Personally, as a
yeah, that's why I said, you know, we'll leave it at that.
As a very conservative Christian, more Orthodox, the oldest Christian religion in the world, I think it's a little bit ironic to have all the so-called conservative Christians in America complaining about that the America has fallen into Satanism, gay marriage, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
While they should be looking at themselves.
Yeah.
And as regards to
which was
Muslims,
Jesus' fundamental teaching, you know, the beam in your eye thing.
Exactly. And, you know, they exactly don't impress me, and I'm a conservative Republican myself.
Mm-hmm.
In regards to the Muslims, I mean,
yeah.
I know that they're the ones that hold the – they want the political power in the Shiites. They don't want the one that set the bureaucracy. Yeah. Shiite Muslims that have control of the country would be Iran, which used to be Persia, and people seem to forget about it.
Yeah, good point, Peter. Thanks a lot for the call. This is a subject that needs a little more discussion than we have the time for right now. But do Americans believe everything our government tells us? Could we possibly just be sheep in a herd? Paul Craig Roberts will join us next. Former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration to reveal how gullible we might be. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. I was in China when a July Harris poll reported that 50% of Americans still believe that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction when Bush invaded that country, and that 64% of Americans still believe that Saddam Hussein had strong links with al-Qaeda, writes Paul Craig Roberts. Paul Craig Roberts, an economist, former senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, former assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, former editor with the Wall Street Journal. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you here. You write, first of all, your past conservative and Reagan Republican credentials are impeccable, and yet you are one of the most outspoken writers right now, worried or concerned, putting forward the idea that the Bush administration and their cronies are a threat to the United States. Am I accurately portraying you?
Yes, they are a grave threat. I think that every constitutional scholar in the country knows that. We are watching them destroy the Bill of Rights and create a police state. We've watched them use intentional lies to start a war that's created an incredible, catastrophic mess in the Middle East. So, yes, I think they're definitely a threat. I would regard the Bush people to be a greater threat to America than the Muslim terrorist.
I would not disagree with that. I'm curious, though, why, Paul Craig Roberts, your former colleagues and friends in the Republican Party and the Wall Street Journal editorial page don't get it.
Well, they may get it, Tom, but they're a different kind of people, and I don't want you or your listeners to think that I'm full of myself, but I was never a partisan Republican. I was, chosen to be associate editor and columnist in the Wall Street Journal because I was opening up entirely new theories of economic policy. And I was chosen to be the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury to implement that because I wrote the tax bill that Reagan adopted as his basic campaign issue. So I was in there because I was identified with the issues that at that time had bipartisan support. In fact, the Democrats in the U.S. Senate were actually much stronger supporters of the supply side approach to policy than were the Democrats. I mean, than were the Republicans. So I was never there in order to peddle influence, lobby. You know, most people who get these presidential appointments, they want them so they can come out and start lobby firms or join lobby firms or go to Wall Street. And it's a career-enhancing, money-making business for most people, and it never appealed to me. I'm not part of that. So you can't expect people who are making large sums of money to come out and attack or tell the truth about connections that are supplying that money to them.
Yeah. In other words, the short answer is that Republicans, conservatives, and I use those words with I wince as I use those words because I have tremendous respect for Dwight Eisenhower, for example, and even Barry Goldwater, frankly. But neither one of them, I think, would describe Bush and his friends as either Republican or conservative. But the people who today call themselves Republicans and conservatives, at least the few among them who may understand what's really going on, are not speaking out because they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them.
Right.
Bottom line.
It's the end of their career.
Yeah.
See,
yeah,
if my career was tied in the normal way, it'd be the end of mine. It may be anyhow, because they'll do whatever they can to smear me.
In this most recent article here, Gullible Americans, you talk about, you know, governments lie all the time, you say, and you mention Leo Strauss, and you also point out how Hitler seized dictatorial power as a consequence of the attack on the Reichstagsgebäude, the parliament building.
Right.
And I'm wondering to what, and you say you are a student of Russian studies when you learned the Tsarist secret police would set off bombs and then blame those that they wanted to arrest. How far do you think this has gone in the United States now? How far do you think it can go? And do you think that maybe Lincoln's old maxim that you can fool some of the people all of the time, and you can fool all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time, might ultimately come back and be their undoing?
Well, I hope so. I did see a recent poll from, I think it was a Scripps Howard poll, that 36% of the Americans polled do not believe the official story of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So it may well be that you can't fool all the people all the time. And, of course, Bush's poll numbers are very low. So I think people are seeing through all the propaganda about the war in Iraq. And
that's interesting. If his approval rating is at 35%, which was the last number I saw, and 37% of Americans think that 9/11 was a government conspiracy, there's more people who think that the government did 9/11 than who approve of Bush.
That may be.
That's pretty strange.
That may be the case, Tom. I myself don't have a conspiracy theory. I don't have any theory about 9/11.
Yeah, I'm still agnostic about it. I think there's just way too much we don't know.
What we have to know, Tom, is that scientific principles are not a conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
And it is a known scientific fact that it's strictly impossible for any building anywhere on Earth to collapse by pancaking in pre-fall time. This is not an opinion. It's an established scientific fact.
Yeah.
Pre-fall time is a time that passes in the absence of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And pancaking is the use of energy to break loose support. In other words, to overcome resistance.
Right.
So the fact of resistance in pancaking makes free fall time impossible. Again, this is not an opinion, it's a basic scientific fact. So, since we know the buildings fell in free fall time, I mean virtually free fall time, we know that the account that they fell by pancaking cannot be true.
Right.
So we have no idea.
The problem then becomes who, why, how, when. Yeah. You know, it's
well,
there's a million unanswered questions.
Yeah, and why does no one want to answer them or have a discussion or a real investigation? I mean, we haven't had a real investigation. You know, we now have the two co-chairmen of the 9/11 Commission who've written another book saying that there were actually flaws in the report, that
right.
they didn't tell us that the military had lied,
yeah.
and they didn't tell us that the military had committed perjury so bad that the commission thought they should refer it to the Justice Department for criminal prosecution.
And these guys have experienced a virtual blackout in the media, and as soon as the book came out and they started talking about it, all of a sudden Britain discovered that they had some terrorists in their backyard.
Yeah,
what a surprise.
That's another phony plot.
Yeah.
I suppose you saw the report that the former British ambassador, Craig Murray, says that the whole thing is concocted.
Well, they haven't arrested anybody yet.
Well, I mean, everyone they picked up, I think they've turned all but two of them loose.
Yeah, well, and you know, they're the ones that they're holding, they have not yet formally charged with any crime. They have not yet formally arrested them. They're merely in detention.
Right.
And the reason why, apparently, is that there's no evidence. And there's no evidence because even if they were planning on doing something, their plans hadn't gotten to the point where there was any evidence of them. You know, no passports, no visas, no bomb, no nothing.
Yeah, it all came. What happened was apparently the Pakistanis were torturing somebody.
Right.
And he came up with this. And so this was the basis for. I mean, somebody's torturing you, you'll tell them anything.
Yep. And this isn't the first time these kind of things have come out.
Right.
Paul Craig Roberts, we just have a few seconds. I mean, literally about 30 seconds left. Where do we go with this? You're doing your best to wake up America. I'm doing my best to wake up America. It seems like that's the best route.
Yes, I don't know what else we can do. I really don't. We have to just hope that the old saw is right, that the pen is mightier than the sword. If it is, we'll prevail. If it doesn't, we'll go down.
Yeah, living by cliches is a tough one.
I know, it is.
On the other hand, cliches are cliches, usually because there's a germ of truth to them, to use another old cliche. Paul Craig Roberts, I want to thank you, sir, for the great writing that you're doing and the service to your country that you're performing in continuing to discuss these issues. I think it's absolutely marvelous.
Well, Tom, I thank you for doing the same thing on the air.
Yeah, we'll continue to. Paul Craig Roberts, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration and former Senior Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And informationclearinghouse.info carries your stuff. Is there a specific website for you, Mr. Roberts?
No. A lot of stuff appears on Information Clearinghouse, a lot on Counterpunch, and a lot on VDare.com.
Great. Thank you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I am a patriot, and I love my country, because my country is all I know. I'm one of you in my family, people who understand me. I've got nowhere else to go.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Lauren says that a caller wanted to remind people that HBO's Katrina documentary, parts 1 and 2, are on tonight and parts 3 and 4 tomorrow night, presumably at 9 p.m., but Eastern time. And it may just echo across the country based on that, but I would suggest you check your local listings just to make sure. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the program. Victoria Jones, our senior interminable Bush answer correspondent, with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Well, Hey, Tom. Yes, I attended President Bush's news conference this morning, and the answers were indeed interminable, which is one of the reasons, I think, why he never got to my question, which was very frustrating because I had a good one. But it wasn't only me. He didn't get to an awful lot of people. He took not very many questions, and the people he did take had follow-up questions, too. And this was a source of frustration for the press corps because a lot of people had questions for the president. His answers were just unusually long. And
he was filibustering? Was he filibustering?
Part of it, I think, was filibustering. Part of it, he just seemed to be a bit loquacious. And at one point, people were putting their hands up, and he basically told them to put their hands down. It was bothering him, and that he was mentioned that he was basically getting crotchety at his age, and people were not to interrupt his peroration.
Maybe he's back on his Ritalin or something.
Well, he could be. But after he'd said the word peroration, he stopped and looked around at everybody and turned to one reporter from NBC and said, "Look it up."
I'll bet he rehearsed that line.
You've got to think he did.
I'll bet he did.
Absolutely.
So did anybody ask him if anybody from the Justice Department had been in contact with the Thai government to ask them to arrest this guy in the JonBenet Ramsey case? And if that timing was more than coincidental with regard to the release of this judge's finding that Bush has committed high crimes and misdemeanors.
I have to tell you that nobody did.
Yeah, that's a shame.
And you won't be shocked to hear that, I know.
Yeah.
You may be disappointed, but you won't be shocked. No, nobody did ask that. There were questions about Iraq. There were questions about Lebanon. There was even a question about Plan B, the over the counter next day pregnancy pill, which his answer was quite interesting actually about that, in which he said he supported the prescriptions for underage people for that.
That contradicts his own FDA.
Isn't that? Well, it was interesting because previously I think he'd supported prescriptions for everybody for that. He seemed to be saying that he supported it over the counter for those who are of age.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, which is the FDA's position, is it not?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
He seemed to be supporting the FDA, which really was a bit of a surprise, I think, for many of us.
Yeah.
He did say, he said, "We're not leaving," talking about Iraq, "so long as I'm the president. That would be a terrible mistake. We're not going to leave before the mission's complete. These aren't joyous times. These are challenging times, and they are difficult times."
And he seems to revel in that.
You get the impression, but we got the very definite impression that there is no question that no matter what happens in Iraq, there is no change that could happen in Iraq that he would see in the next couple of years that would bring about a withdrawal by this administration.
In that case, he clearly has no plan to, quote, win, end quote.
To what? I'm sorry?
If he says the only terms under which we will leave are when we win, and he says, "and we will not leave while I'm president," then he's saying, "we will not win while I'm president," is he not?
Well, he says, "we're not going to leave before the mission's complete." I think he sees completing the mission as more long-term than his presidency.
But he has not defined what completing the mission means.
Well, I think I think that morphs from day to day. I think an Iraq and Syria that can stand on its own feet, a government that can govern itself. You've heard the different definitions, the different bits of rhetoric that do seem to change, and that changes each time the situation deteriorates. Pretty soon it'll be, an Iraq that can just barely hang together will be the definition of success.
Right. Yesterday, Cindy Sheehan got a pot shot in at Karl Rove out in California, I believe it was. He was doing a $200 plate dinner or whatever. Any repercussions from that?
Not really. There seems to be a feeling of that, oh, well, that's Cindy, that's to be expected.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the response to that, quite honestly.
Yeah.
And the feeling really is, I think the feeling is pretty much what your feeling is about Karl Rove, that he's extremely busy fixing the next election.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, my. And we've got to do something about that. Is there a sense among the press corps, do you think, that the Republicans are stealing elections, or are they blissfully unaware?
I'm not sure they're blissfully unaware, but I think that they have sensed that the Democrats, if they get more organized, can, in fact, win, that the polls are correct enough that the Dems really do have a lead.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Red flag in the bassinet, oil and blood on the bayonet, crowded downtown, hit the floor. What are we fighting for?
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, telling the truth that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Let's take a look right now at what the situation is with regard to the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones.
Divide the 1,249 days, the length of the ongoing war in Iraq, 5 days longer than the U.S. involvement in World War II, as of today. The following security and other developments in Iraq reported Monday as of 1,000 hours GMT by Reuters. Dateline Kirkuk. U.S. forces killed a 10-year-old boy accidentally on Sunday when they fired at a car approaching their patrol in that northern city. Countrywide, the Iraqi army arrested 103 suspected insurgents during the past 48 hours in different cities of Iraq. In Iskandaria, two policemen were wounded when a roadside bomb went off beside their patrol in that city. In Basra, gunmen killed Fahil al-Magusi, a colonel in the Facility Protection Service, on Sunday in that southern city. Also in Basra, gunmen killed two off-duty members of the Interior Ministry Intelligence Service on Sunday. In other developments in Baghdad, Saddam Hussein and six former army commanders went on trial on charges of killing tens of thousands of Kurdish villagers in a genocidal campaign that devastated northern Iraq in 1988. Meanwhile, John McCain, you have to wonder, you know, is he lying intentionally? Is he really that dumb? Is the Republican PR machine so competent that he's not lying, he's not dumb, he's simply fooled? But the stats are pretty unambiguous. I mean, you know, pretty straightforward. The two most recent polls, do you support a timetable to withdraw from Iraq? There was one back in June. These are CNN polls conducted by Opinion Research Corporation. There was one back in June. 53% of Americans support a timetable to withdraw. 41% say no. So that's a majority, 53%, more than half. And then on August 2nd and 3rd, there was the poll, do you support a withdrawal, a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, or no timetable? And 40% said no timetable, 57% said timetable. And yet, on Meet the Press this weekend, John McCain says the following.
Most of the Americans, when you're asked, do you want to set a date for withdrawal, say no.
And David Gregory, who was interviewing him, didn't even say, Senator McCain, I'm sorry, I work for the news media here. We look at this stuff, and you're wrong. Most of Americans say, yeah, set a date. Set a timetable. So, you know, what's the deal? And didn't, you know, what did John McCain not learn from Vietnam about the inability to occupy a country by military force? You can't occupy a country by military force over the long term without incredible expense. I mean, this is what destroyed the Roman Empire, was their attempts to occupy foreign nations. It was what destroyed the Greek Empire. It was, you just, you could argue it was one of the areas where Hitler was badly overextended. It is certainly harming the United States. But he says maybe we need more troops.
So you need more U.S. soldiers on the ground now?
I think so. We took troops from places like Ramadi, which are still not under control, into Baghdad. We've had to send in additional troops as they are. All along, we have not had enough troops on the ground to control the situation. Many, many people knew that, and we're paying a very heavy price for it.
Now, that may well be that the reason for that is that you can't do an occupation. You can't rebuild a country after a war. First of all, you have a war against a country. You take out its government. You seize its government buildings. You take control of its economy. You now own that country, right? We did that in March, April, and May of 2003. So the invasion was over. It was successful. It was illegal, but it was successful. Then began the occupation. Now, what was the purpose of the occupation? If the purpose of the occupation was to build a democracy in Iraq and have Iraq stand up on their own two feet, then the thing that we should have done is the same thing that we did in Germany and Japan, which is said, here's a bunch of money. We broke your country. We'll pay to fix it. You guys, you know how to build buildings. You know how to build hospitals. You know how to build schools. You've done it. You did it before. You built the entire country. Baghdad was the Paris of the Middle East. It was a very cosmopolitan, very, very wealthy, very successful city in 1990. Here's some cash. Make it that way again. And for one-tenth of what we have spent so far with Halliburton and Bechtel and Blackwater and all these other companies, we could have simply given the money to the Iraqis and said, you guys do it. Build your country back up. And if our goal was to build a democracy, I suspect we probably could have done it had we done that. But instead, we used an army, not bulldozers and cranes, not reconstruction, but we used an army, not police, which guarantee security, but an army. Armies blow things up and kill people. That's what they do. They're very good at it. And there's a time and place for that. But armies are not designed to rebuild countries, and they're not designed to conduct police actions, to enforce the law. They're designed to blow things up and kill people. But we used an army to occupy Iraq. And that in and of itself should have been a red flag. I mean, and John McCain should have figured that out. We should have been looking at that going, oh, wait a minute. This isn't the way it's supposed to work. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. 866-440-8466. Jude in Seattle. Hey, Jude, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I wanted to thank you, Tom, very much for having the courage to be such a great example of an American patriot. My call was to state that we really are in a call to arms, but not with guns and aggression. And the gentleman you had, Mr. Roberts, he was so perfect because he said it's by the pen, not by the sword.
Yes.
I talked with the Office of Professional Responsibility out of the Justice Department. And when I call, I usually have great trepidation because I just don't know what's going to go on. But it's in regards to last week with Judge Taylor and mm-hmm. her decision. And then within about an hour and a half of Gonzalez coming out, you know, and having a stay of that. My question to the Office of Professional Responsibility was, who in that department protects our Constitution and protects me as an American citizen? And her response back was, we in this office, we look into any criminal abuse or misconduct by federal attorneys. And I said, well, there was a great line. I says, explain this to me like I'm a five-year-old. Is not Gonzalez a federal attorney? And she said, yes. And I said, what then can I and other people do? So she ended up giving me the address to write them directly. And I wanted to know if maybe you would put that out if you thought that was something credible for your listeners.
I would be pleased to. First of all, you can say it on the air here in just a moment. And secondly, you can go over to TomHartman.com and post it on our message board if you
see. I'm a retired hospice nurse, and I don't have a computer, and it's so hard in the library because they're always jammed with people.
Mm-hmm.
So
Well, why don't you give it to us online right now? And I'm guessing that there's probably several people in our chat room who will copy it down and we'll post it.
Thank you, Tom. It's the United States Department of Justice, Office of Professional Responsibility, 950 Pennsylvania Avenue, room 3266, Washington, D.C., 20533. And I have to go back up to the 950 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest.
Okay. Why don't you just do it one more time, Jude?
Okay. United States Department of Justice, Office of Professional Responsibility, 950 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20530, room 3266.
Great. Jude, thank you very much for the call.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom.
And for having the courage of your convictions.
God, you know, just it's time.
Yeah, I agree.
It's time.
We live in those days.
Thank you, sir.
Pat in Red Oak, Iowa. Hey, Pat.
Hi, Tom. Based on what I hear, people seem to be focused on the fact that a terror attack could only occur by an airplane. It seems to me that people need to think more about where they want to be a year from now, 3 years from now, 5 years. How do you want to spend the rest of your life? If we have to be searched to go to a shopping center, x-rayed to go into a shopping mall,
mm-hmm.
How do we want to spend the rest of our lives? It seems to me that the best way to handle things is to vote Democratic, clear the slate, offer a hand of starting to heal and straighten things up.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree with you, Pat. Just like the best welfare program is a job, the best anti-terrorism program is a rational foreign policy. Pat, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Let's head on down the road to somewhere. I gotta go, and you don't know how it feels. You don't know how it feels. No, you don't know how it feels.
And welcome back to The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Sophia in Citrus Heights, California. Hey, Sophia.
Oh, hi. I've never heard anybody say anything about this. Sometime before 9/11, there was a PBS special on the building of the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of it, they said that they packed the steel uprights with explosives so that when it was time to bring it down, it'd be easy.
You're kidding.
And I thought, I didn't hear that right. That can't be. So I waited for it to come back on. That is exactly what they said. They said every building has a lifespan, and eventually it's going to have to come down. So when it's time to bring it down, we went ahead and packed the interior steel uprights with explosives so it'd be easy.
I find that really I'm not calling you a liar or anything, but I find that so hard to believe. I'm just astounded.
I know, and I was astounded, too. And I'm also astounded that nobody's ever brought that up, because I can't possibly be the only person that saw that.
Yeah, yeah. You would think that would be all over the 9/11 Who Did It websites.
Kind you of. Would.
Huh, interesting. Well, we'll put the call out, Sophia, and
yeah,
if anybody knows about that, let us know.
It was before, I don't know if it was a year before or 2 years before or what. I know it was before 9/11, but yeah. I don't have a time frame.
Boy, that would explain an awful lot.
Yes, it would.
You know? Huh. Interesting.
Well,
okay.
Maybe your computer people can check on it.
Yeah, it's something worth tracking down. Well, maybe we'll get the folks in the chat room on it. Sophia, thank you very much.
Okay,
bye. Good to hear from you. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will.
How are you, Tom?
I'm fine. How's our senior curmudgeon today?
I beg your pardon?
How's our senior curmudgeon today?
Oh, boy, you're going to get an earful today, buddy.
Okay, go for it.
Love your show, buddy.
Thank you.
I have to disagree with you, by the way. You guys don't have a snowball's chance in hell with the Democrats. They're so disorganized. They're like a bunch of piranhas. I'm a registered independent, Tom. I've been so ever since I came home from the service.
So am I, Will.
You bet, buddy. And thank God for us, you know what I mean? And by the way, I hope you have a copy of, you know who William Lederer is?
No.
A Nation of Sheep. I do believe he published. I still have an original copy from the 60s.
Yeah.
I managed to save that accidentally.
I remember that. I don't remember the details of it, but yeah.
And I read that quite often, and he refers to, and there was a guy who wrote, I don't know his name right now. Next time I'll give it. It's no big deal. The Fourth Estate. Have you heard about that one?
No.
That's the government that is the propaganda machine for the government, the Fourth Estate.
Well, the Fourth Estate is...
I don't know what he meant by that.
The Fourth Estate is the press, and the whole idea was that there's only one... business, as it were. There's only one non-governmental institution that is specifically given protection in the Constitution of the United States, and that's the press and in the First Amendment. And the idea of the founders and framers of the Constitution was that without a free and independent press, you cannot have a functioning democracy. In fact, Jefferson went so far as to say, if I was given a choice between living in a nation without government but with newspapers or a nation without newspapers but with government, I would surely choose the former. Whichever, you know, that he would choose the one with newspapers and with no government. And this was a guy who was pilloried by the newspapers during his time. I mean, he had newspapers. He was in agony over how the newspapers were ripping him apart.
Thomas, my favorite heroes, and I mean this, was my most famous. I love the guy. That was Thomas Paine.
Yeah, I agree.
But I did lose both his books, Common Sense, and there was another one.
The Rights of Man.
That's it. I lost them all, Tom. But I'll tell you what, this guy, you know what, sometimes you should talk about him because he was the epitome of a patriotic American, a man who fought for freedom and the right for press. And they persecuted that man in this country.
Yeah, that's because he wrote a book called The Age of Reason, in which he suggested that most religions were nonsense and revealed religions were nonsense, and he was basically an atheist. He was arguably a deist, but probably an atheist. And so when he came back to the United States after the French Revolution and died, only seven people, as I recall, maybe six people, fewer than a dozen, showed up for his funeral. He was buried in obscurity in near Greenwich Village, as I recall, in New York. And then there was a bit of a revival around him in the 1800s, and there was a guy from the U.K. who dug him up to take his corpse back to the U.K. for burial, and he was lost at sea.
What is that called when you desecrate a grave?
Yeah.
They hated him so much, and I call it corporate dictatorship, by the way, Tom.
Well, it was the religious folks who hated him, and it was because of his book, The Age of Reason, yeah.
Tom, I'll tell you what, there is a true, I mean, if there is ever a hero to emulate, that is my man. And I also have tremendous, by the way, my favorite president, if you wish to know, and your listeners, Dwight David Eisenhower.
Yeah, he was a good man. Just to put a fine point here on Thomas Paine, his book, The Rights of Man, is really worth reading. He lays out in that book the idea of progressive income tax, the idea of Social Security, the idea of unemployment insurance. I mean, just, you know, point after point after point. He basically lays out Franklin Roosevelt's entire agenda in that book, The Rights of Man. It's brilliant. I think it's Harvey K or David K, K-A-Y-E, anyways, his last name. He has a new biography out about Thomas Paine that is absolutely one of the very best histories of the United States that I've ever read anywhere. It's just marvelous. Speaking of books, by the way, my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, is starting to ship right now to bookstores. It'll be out in a week or so, and I think you can get it online in a few of the online stores right now. So we'll be back after the news here on the Tom Hartmann Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. Welcome back to our show. Syndicated, by the way, by Air America Radio. Pleased to be with you.
I'm not making this up.
No, I'm not. I'm really not. I'm pleased to be with you. In fact, let's check out our activism alert for the day.
May take all week down, it may take long out. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Yes, indeed, my friends. If you're not sure what to do, here's a place to start. Contact your member of Congress, your representative in the House of Representatives, and your two senators, and tell them to support network neutrality for the Internet. This is from The Nation. Lured by huge checks handed out by the country's top lobbyists, members of Congress could soon strike a blow against Internet freedom as they seek to resolve the hot-button controversy over preserving so-called network neutrality. The bill did not... There's a piece of legislation passing through Congress very quickly right now. Not only precludes net neutrality safeguards, but also eliminates local community oversight of digital communications provided by cable and phone giants. It also sets the stage for the privatized, consolidated, and unregulated communication system that is at the core of the phone and cable company's political agenda. As Jeffrey Chester writes in The Nation, in both the House and Senate versions of the bill, Americans are described as consumers and subscribers, not citizens. A handful of companies stand to gain incredible monopoly power from such legislation, especially AT&T, Comcast, Time Warner, and Verizon. They have already used their political clout in Washington to secure for the phone and cable industries a stunning 98% control of the U.S. residential market for high-speed Internet. At this moment, Senators Ron Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon, who I spoke with this morning, Maine Republican Olympia Snow and North Dakota Democrat Byron Dorgan have joined forces to protect the Internet. They are threatening to filibuster this legislation on the floor of the Senate. Well, they're not threatening to. They are filibustering it. Ron Wyden put a hold on this thing. And this is going to require Ted Stevens, who is the Alaska senator who is sucking up to the phone and cable lobbies, to get 60 of his colleagues to break the filibuster. So I would suggest that you contact your United States senator. I certainly intend to call, I actually talked with Ron Wyden this morning and said, good on you for this. Congratulations. But I intend to call Senator Smith, Gordon Smith, the Republican from Oregon, who I believe is opposed to net neutrality. He's in favor of the big corporations. I intend to call his office when I get off the air today and say, hey, support network neutrality. Not that it will necessarily do any good with Gordon Smith. I mean, the guy's a right-winger, but who knows? And I'm going to call my member of Congress, Darlene Hooley, and let her office know what I think about this as well. And if you would like to call Congress, their number toll-free, 888-355-3588. 1-888-355-3588. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM, and Steve in Atlanta, Georgia on the line. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. This a report from down here in the South.
Okay.
As you know from living in Georgia, you know, you talk about feeling like a blueberry on a big strawberry plant.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because I lived in Georgia for, I don't know, 15, 16 years, something like that,
mm-hmm.
and in Atlanta or in the northern suburbs of Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
Roswell and Marietta, and it never seemed that right wing to me. You know, I mean, there's a lot of good Democrats. I mean, Max Cleland was a senator. He was a Democrat. He was a conservative Democrat, but he was a Democrat. He had Zell Miller as governor. At the time, he was a fairly rational guy. I'm convinced he has, you know, Alzheimer's or something like that.
It's gotten worse.
Yeah.
One of the reasons we have.
Well, actually, my member of Congress was Newt Gingrich. So I guess maybe I'm, you know, recalibrating my memories or something.
Gingy Nunu is really trying to get in the news lately, isn't he?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's gotten worse. One of the reasons why is we have absolutely no other side on the radio anymore or TV.
Yeah.
You know, Air America got, you know, it's gone.
Yeah.
And so all we get are these other guys. And it's very interesting talking politics down here. You know, it's very easy when I talk to a lot of my Republican friends to admit that to get them to admit that the Republicans are doing a crappy job. But once I try to say vote Democrat, then they turn away.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, it's so easy right now for the Democrats to get a message out. All they have to do is just start saying things like universal health care, no NAFTA, clean elections, no more tax shelters. And these issues are really resonating with people.
Yeah, they are. The large percentages, 70, 80, 90% of the population will support the various, and you know, strengthen Social Security, the various issues, strengthen pensions. Let's go back to pensions. You know, companies offering 401ks, that's nonsense. They should be offering pensions.
That's right. Even my strongest Republican friends, once I start, you know, they know full well how the CEOs are screwing things up.
Oh, yeah.
And the CEOs and Republicans.
Yeah, yeah. But they're making money hand over fist, so it's that's what's going on. Steve, thanks again for the call and the heads up. Good talking to you. Kate in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to let you know, I hope this doesn't get lost in the dead zone of news press information that's out there, but just after Bush said this morning, I heard on the press conference, just after he said that we'd be staying, as long as he's president, we'd be staying in Iraq, I heard a reporter, you know, from kind of the background shout out a question, what did Iraq have to do with 9/11? And I thought, whoa, that's great. And then Bush said nothing. And then he went on to what it seemed to me, you know, bumble around trying to find talking points and go on from there and weave it together.
Well, this is what he said on the path.
We've got no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
Exactly right. And I was waiting to hear what he was going to say. And it was as though it slipped out. You know, he didn't really want it to slip out, but it did, and then he had to backtrack. So since it just happened today, I think it's really an important thing to try to get one of your sound bites out there and use today's date for it.
Yeah, I'll have to see if we can track
down. I don't know
how
you find that.
Maybe we can track down the audio for the press conference and grab that. That's interesting. Kate, thanks for the heads up on that. Appreciate it. Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Cynthia, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. And to piggyback on the last caller, I believe he also said there were no weapons of mass destruction. So anybody in Pennsylvania should contact Casey's office, tell them to run a clip of Santorum saying we found them, and Bush saying they weren't there.
Yeah, there you go. You would think that this thing would be a cakewalk. It's
right.
I don't know.
Yeah, Tom, I called about Iraq.
Yeah.
I remember when a man named Leslie Gell from the Council on Foreign Relations wrote an article in the New York Times saying they wanted to divide Iraq. Then we sent Death Squad Negroponte over there.
And all of a sudden, people started showing up dead.
Right, with a man named James Steele, who was Special Forces in El Salvador.
Yep.
When people were being massacred all over the place, that led to a civil war.
Yep.
This is what is happening in Iraq. And, it's driving me crazy that people will not acknowledge this. These people didn't just start fighting on their own. We started it because nuts like Leslie Gelb and these neocons wanted the place divided and easily managed.
I agree. And because easier to extract the oil.
Yes. And there was a good article about that. It was written by a man named Max Fuller. It's called For Iraq, the Salvador Option Becomes Reality. Everybody needs to read that and understand what is going on and who got us involved in it.
And the article, again, the title of the article
was? It's called For Iraq, the Salvador Option Becomes Reality by Max Fuller.
Max Fuller. Great. I'll look for it. Cynthia, thanks a lot for the call and the heads up. Bill in Seattle. Hey, Bill, we have about a minute before we have to take a break. What's on your mind?
Well, Tom, actually, I was really heartened to hear that a federal judge had, you know, found that George Bush was in violation of the FISA Act last week. But, you know, what's the point? I mean, I just feel like there's so many of these appellate court judges that are willing to do anything. Bush and Reagan appointees that'll do anything.
This is going to go to the Supreme Court, Bill.
Too corrupt.
This is going to go to the Supreme Court, but, you know, keep in mind the Supreme Court has already ruled in the Hamdan case that Bush is essentially guilty of war crimes. I mean, that's the subtext of that ruling. He's in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the UN Conventions. Bill Clinton got investigated over whether or not he inappropriately fired his travel agent. And George W. Bush is guilty of war crimes. I mean, it's and nobody will look into it. We so need adversarial government back. I mean, no matter what you think of the Democratic Party, we so need somebody other than the Republicans running the House and the Senate or both. You know, the House or the Senate or both. Up next, Congress's War on the Working Poor with Alec Dubrow from the International Labor Communications Association. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, you can't turn him into a company man. You can't turn him into a whore. And the boys upstairs just don't understand anymore. Well, the top brass don't like him talking so much. And he won't play what they say to play. And he don't want to change what don't need to change. And there goes the last DJ, who plays what he wants to play.
Sometimes I think I'm the last DJ. I don't know. That's how I started in this business in 1968. Spinning country western, of all things, and I hated country western at the time. I thought, oh no, you know, I was 17 years old, this is awful. Ended up really liking it. Well, I ended up going to a rock and roll station after that. But anyhow, welcome back to the program. 22 minutes past the hour, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. Tom Hartman with you. Alec Dubrow is on the line with us. He's the media coordinator over at the International Labor Communications Association. Their website, ILCA Online, ILCAonline.org. Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. What a coincidence. I got my start as a record critic for Rolling Stone. I didn't know we were both in the music business.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, was it around the same time?
68.
Yeah, well, we're both old farts, too.
Okay. Don't tell them.
Yeah, there you go.
They can't see us on radio.
That's right. Alec, you have written that, or Dick Meister, actually, has written that Congress's Republican leaders belong in prison.
Yeah, so I think that's pretty fair.
Okay.
I guess they deserve a trial first, but
ultimately
they do.
So what's the rationale here? Why is it that we should be putting Denny Hastert and Tom DeLay? Well, Tom DeLay, I guess we already know. Denny Hastert and various others, let's say.
Okay. Well,
Frist.
It's fascinating because I had never given this a thought, or at least I hadn't done the research on it, that the basic law of the land regarding a floor under our wages and overtime is the Fair Labor Standards Act passed,
which was passed in 1938.
Actually, this was a few years after the Wagner Act.
Okay.
And the Fair Labor Standards Act requires Congress to set a minimum wage high enough to guarantee, quote, a standard of living necessary for health, efficiency, and general well-being.
Now, it includes the word health.
Health.
I mean, that sort of would suggest you would have to have a minimum wage high enough to be able to buy health insurance, at least.
Certainly.
I mean, right now, I mean, I don't know what the average person pays for health insurance, but I know the average that we all pay for it is around $11,000 a year when you take everything into consideration.
And what a coincidence, because if you earn the minimum wage full time, you earn $11,000 a year. And that's $200 a week or $900 a month before deductions.
Right.
And as we realize, of course, that is not going to pay anybody for their health, efficiency, and general well-being unless you have a very peculiar standard of that. And So, you know, I advise people who are interested in this to go to our website and read Dick Meister's article on it. But it,
the website is ilcaonline.org.
Right. But it's interesting how many low-wage workers we have and how dire the consequences if they get cheated, which many employers do. Now, I'm assuming, and there's no reason to doubt, that most employers pay according to the letter of the law and do not cheat their employees. But enough of them, because it's a big country, enough of them do. And what I found, looked into it a bit, and it turns out that the federal agency responsible for enforcing the Fair Labor Standards Act is the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor. Now, the Wage and Hour Division currently is headed by an Alfred B. Robinson Jr., who came to the job. He had formerly been, as they say, of counsel, meaning one of the attorneys for a firm called Wimberly Lawson in South Carolina. Among other things that Wimberly Lawson did was to fight unionization in companies.
Mm-hmm.
It said, quote, "While our lawyers remain successful in representing our clients' interest in union organizing," our distinction rests on preventive law philosophy. In other words, they fight the unions if they got a toehold, but really what they would try to do is advise you ways to keep them out in the first place.
Hmm.
And this is the man responsible for overseeing our minimum wage enforcement.
So the law says that members of Congress have to set the minimum wage at a level that is, a standard of living necessary for health, efficiency, and general well-being, end quote. Why are you not suing Congress right now, Alec DeBro?
Me personally? Or well, why is the labor movement?
Yeah.
Well,
right.
To tell you the truth, this it's like any organizations, they respond to the greatest need, the most immediate need. Now that Dick Meister has brought this up, like I say, you know, I read a lot of this stuff. I had never bothered to look at the preamble of the FLSA. We need an internal.
Maybe it'll happen now.
Huh?
Maybe it'll happen.
Look, the chances of impeaching the president for war crimes is mighty slim.
Yeah, well, you just never know. It's Alec DeBro, ilcaonline.org. You can read the article over there. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, we got some interesting, this is interesting. This is from today's press conference, George W. Bush.
The tactics. Now, either you say, yes, it's important we stay there and get it done, or we leave. We're not leaving so long as I'm the president. That would be a huge mistake.
Mm-hmm. So, we're not leaving so long as I'm the president. Yeah. Okay, here's another one.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
Whoa. Now, let's see if that makes the evening news. I would love to know if this clip shows up on NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, MSNBC. I'm willing to bet, well, you know, it's probably illegal in some states. I'm willing to bet rhetorically that it doesn't. Here it is again. This is from today's press conference.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
Nothing. What did Iraq have to do with what? The attack on the World Trade Center. Nothing. Uh-huh. By the way, the British authorities just announced that they are charging 11 of the 23 people that they had taken into custody in connection with a suspected plot The decision to press, this is from the New York Times today, an article by Alan Cowell. The decision to press formal charges against 11 people came after days of growing public skepticism about the extent of the plot, first announced on August 10th, when the police warned that the suspected conspirators had planned to commit mass murder on what one officer called an unimaginable scale. I would add, right after Ned Lamont beat Joe Lieberman. On that day, police rounded up most of the suspects in early morning raids, saying they had thwarted a plot to use liquid explosives to bomb airliners flying to the United States from London. Ms. Hemming, she's the spokesperson for the British prosecutor's office, said eight of the 11 suspects today had been accused of conspiracy to commit murder and an offense under new counterterrorism laws of preparing acts of terrorism. Three others have been charged under counterterrorism legislation dating to 2000, she said. Interesting. She says, inquiries will span the globe. The enormity of the alleged plot will be matched only by our determination to follow every lead and line of inquiry. I guess Tony Blair has decided if he doesn't get out there and do something fast, he's in big trouble. By the way, this story from the Kurdish media, the United Kurdish Voice, Kurdish Media Service, KurdishMedia.com is the website. Reporters Without Borders appealed today for clemency in a trial that began yesterday in Baghdad, in which Al-Wasit editor Ayad Al-Tamimi and reporter Ahmed Mutare Abbas faced the possibility of long prison terms on charges of libeling the police, judicial, and municipal authorities in Al-Kut, southeast of the capital. You get this? Paul Bremer must have passed a law that said it's against the law to libel the police and municipal authorities. You can't. Oh, my. The trial concerned several articles published last year, including one criticizing the judicial system and one about alleged police corruption. Arrested in April of 2005 on the orders of the mayor of Kawit, they have already served six-month prison terms imposed by the Al-Kut court. They are now being tried on four counts of violating Article 226 of the Iraqi Criminal Code. The case was finally transferred to a Baghdad court at their request on the grounds that the judges in Al-Kut were biased against them. Reporters Without Borders said the situation of these two journalists reflects the current climate in Iraq, which has not been favorable for the development of a truly independent press. And then they add, we're bringing democracy to Iraq. They add, there have been a wave of arrests of journalists since the start of August, especially in the northern Kurdish region, where around a dozen journalists covering peaceful demonstrations in the Sulaymaniyye area have been arrested and held for several hours. Cases have been reported of police destroying photographers' material, and an Associated Press correspondent in the region was banned by authorities for covering protests. Seven other journalists were arrested during a demonstration on 13 August in Sulaymaniyye, in which one of the Kurdish region's most important cities. Two of them were still being held yesterday, although it was hoped they'd be freed soon following a call from a local journalist defense group. That's from Reporters Without Borders. Not a good thing. Not a good thing at all. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was trying to understand the guys who called earlier in your show and said that Islamic nations are fascist nations because the corporations and the government are merged. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Basically, the whole Republican, conservative, right-wing bunch want the word fascist associated with Islam. Although they would never associate it with Christianity. They wouldn't say that the bomber, I'm forgetting his name, was it Eric Rudolph, who blew up the Olympics in Atlanta?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That he was a Christo-fascist.
Right.
They wouldn't say that Tim McVeigh was a Christo-fascist, although, if you want to accept their definitions, you would have to.
Exactly. Well, I remember when the ports deal with the United Arab Emirates came up, and you explained that the company that wanted to take over the running of our ports was owned by the UAE's government.
That's right.
And maybe it's just peculiar to oil-rich nations where you have monarchies that want to keep wealth in their families. So the ism in those cases would be monarchism, not fascism, right?
Yeah. Just monarchy, yeah.
But those nations' governments are different than the governmental visions of terrorist cells of radicals who want totalitarian theocracy. And I imagine they don't like those monarchs who do business with the West and China, India, and Japan. And I think they even see those monarchs as corrupt. So I think fascism is not synonymous with totalitarianism. Maybe it's a subset. What do you think? Is the UAE example where people on the right try to tie fascism with Islamic radical theocrats?
No, I agree with you. The situation in Dubai or Kuwait or any of those other countries that are Saudi Arabia that are monarchies are really, I would say, if you want to put an ism on it, they're a modern version of feudalism.
Yes.
And or monarchy, but it goes beyond monarchy. In my opinion, the reason why the right wingers are so eager to conflate the words fascism and Islam are twofold. Number one, they want to neutralize the word fascism or redefine it so that we don't remember that when Mussolini and Franco and Hitler began fascist regimes, they were overtly the merging of corporate and state interests. And Mussolini went so far as to even dissolve parliament and created as the, forgive my bad Italian, but the Cameo de Fascistio Corporaciones, and the Chamber of Fascist Corporations. And, you know, if you lived in Verona, then your representative was a representative from the largest corporation in Verona. That's how it worked. And they want us to forget that because that's what they're all about. They want to desensitize us to the word fascist in the context of it being very similar to the Bill Frist ideology or the George W. Bush the Republican ideology by and large. And then, of course, they want to demonize Islam because there's a major effort here underway to demonize Islam in the United States. And what's spooky about that is that when, you know, the last time, I mean, we've seen this movie before, the last time a state demonized not just a religion, but the people who are born into and practice a religion was Hitler in Germany, you know, going after the Jews. And it's a movie that I don't think we want to see played out again.
Well, I do know that there is no such thing as separation of church and state in Islam because you can't separate anything from God in the traditional Muslim mind. Conversely, theocratic Christians don't believe in separation of church and state, but do believe in separation of church and corporations, who in their mind are better rulers and must be exempt from morals and virtues, but have all the rights of human beings who do not have, they do not have to follow, wait a minute. Yeah, the corporations don't have to follow morals, and in fact, they have more rights than humans.
In some regard, I think I would back up from that, though, and I would say if you're going to say that in Islam there's no separation between church and state, you would have to say the same thing is true of Judaism and Christianity, because
But that's a Western thought, you know, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, give unto
I was just going to say, you know, Jesus explicitly said, you know, when the person brought him a coin and he says, you know, whose picture's on Caesar, give unto Caesar, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. But you have Christians all over the world who, and particularly here in the United States, who are aggressively trying to take over the government.
Oh, definitely.
And so, you know, are they crypto-fascists? Are they theocrats? I mean,
I think
yeah.
You're right. Where can we go to get education on Mussolini and Franco's fascism, since they're the early models? Because if you go on the web, there are people who want to connect fascism with the left because Hitler's party had the words socialism and workers in it, but they forget that the party had the words nationalist and German in it, too. And
yeah.
I think Hitler was just a good propagandist who wanted to attract people from all political perspectives.
The Wikipedia entries are actually pretty solid.
Okay.
If you go to Wikipedia dot whatever it is,
so if I could search Mussolini's fascism
and just look up Mussolini's entry and look up fascism. Yeah,
okay.
I would start there.
Thank you.
So you're welcome, Bonnie. Thanks a lot for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, your radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Our number 1-866-440-8466. You can drop into our live chat room at tomhartmann.com. Click the live chat link and drop by and say hi. I'm going to go read the chat room here during the break, and we will be back with your calls and more right after this.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. One day the earth woke up and said, boy, it's getting hot. And remember all those trees I had, but now there ain't a lot. And my eyes kept slowly trickling down to where the party's at. And if everybody's going there, well, that's the end of that.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you 9.5 minutes before the hour. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour in 10 seconds. Dave in Los Angeles on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I heard you talking about Bush's press conference earlier.
Yeah.
We were watching it and chatting on a stock chat line, and we were just incredulous that he has a talking point now that a broken Iraq is a threat to America. And I can't believe they're floating this out there, figuring that no one's going to ask the question, who broke it?
Yeah, it's because it was a threat to America back when it was not broken. It was, I'm seriously starting to think that the thing that we should do is hand the country back over to Saddam Hussein. He at least knew how to run it.
Everyone at the beginning was telling him that, even Colin Powell is the one with the Pottery Barn theory.
Yeah.
And everyone on the left was saying, hey, look, you really want to think this over. And they ended up precisely doing what everyone said it was going to happen, break and go into a civil war.
Yeah. And this is Chuck Hagel, the former president of the company that became ES&S Voting Machine Company, on whose machines he ran for election for the Senate from Nebraska. And, gee, what a surprise he won. I've been predicting ever since 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I learned that he was the former head of the voting machine company, that he will one day run for president and probably win. In any case, here he is positioning himself for president, the Republican Chuck Hagel of Nebraska.
The fact is the future of Iraq will be determined by the Iraqi people, just like it was in Vietnam. The answer, in my opinion, is not to just keep feeding more American troops into it. The Iraqi people have already made some decisions here. We in fact, are in probably a low-grade, maybe a very defined civil war. You've got corruption everywhere, as bad as it's ever been. You've got uncontrollables that we can't control, we can't deal with. Iran probably has more influence in Iraq than we do at this point. I've said start withdrawing troops. We Americans in the middle of a civil war that we have less and less control and influence over every day. How does that stabilize things? This is going to play out, Chris, on its own. I'm not saying pull out of Iraq. That's not what I've said. I've said start withdrawing troops. We have to show the Iraqi people, and this obviously cuts right to the great anti-Americanism by any poll, by any measurements there, that we are not there to predetermine their outcome. We're not there to control or to govern. They are going to have to do that. Now, the fact is, bottom line, Chris, there are very few options here. We don't have.
Yeah. So anyhow, this is on Fox News Sunday. That was Chuck Hagel, who spent about 20 years of his life working for George Bush Sr., by the way.
One other last point, Tom. Another point he made in the press conference was the roadmap now. Where do we go in Lebanon, and how does that progress? You notice he brought up bringing together a private consortium of industry, a private industry leaders, and look at rebuilding the bridges, rebuilding schools. All I could think was, oh, here comes another round of no-bid contracts for Halliburton.
There you go. Yeah, what a surprise. Fascism at work in its purest sense, its most technical sense.
Create Dave, your own market.
Yeah, there you go. Dave, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Fred in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind today? Fred? No, Fred. We'll put Fred on hold, and we'll go to Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for talking to me again.
Sure.
I'm the Education Director for America and Solidarity, and we're putting together an event against this Peru Free Trade Agreement that's coming up in the next 3 months with the Sierra Club.
Great.
And
good
so
on
I'm sorry?
I said great. Good on you.
Yeah, we're calling it the Party for the Amazon, building a movement towards a fair trade policy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a website, and I'm hoping that your listeners might take up the challenge and go to their local Sierra Club and try to put this on in their town.
Okay. How do people find out about it?
Okay, it's partyfortheamazon.blogspot.com.
Okay.
And we want trade unionists, environmentalists, anybody who cares about fair trade and hates free trade.
Okay, partyfortheamazon.blogspot.com.
That's right.
Great. Jeff, thanks a lot for the heads up.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. There, John McCain, by the way, this, you know, I played this earlier, but I think it's just, it's so important to point this out. This is how tragic our media has become. Two polls in the last 4 months done by CNN show that the majority of Americans favor a timeline to withdraw from Iraq. And John McCain goes on Meet the Press and says this without being corrected by the reporter who's sitting right next to him.
And most of the Americans, when you're asked, do you want to set a date for withdrawal, say no.
And this is how these things get out there. Is, you know, Republicans go on TV and they say Democrat Party, or they say, you know, most Americans are supportive of the president's policy, or most, you know, whatever, quack, quack, quack. And this is how this nonsense gets out there, and it's just it's a shame. Let's try this again with Fred in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Fred. Fred, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
You got to listen to your phone, not your radio, because there's a delay.
This is Fred calling, first-time caller from Eugene, where mm-hmm. we've been receiving your program for about 3 weeks, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like it.
Well, thank you. We're very, very pleased to be on the air.
I believe it is. I just love your insights and your knowledge. What I wanted to just bring up was something that every time I hear a thing about why do they hate us reminds me of a Harper's Magazine article that was written before 9/11 by then the Kansas City Middle East correspondent.
Mm-hmm. You got just 5-10 seconds here, Fred.
Anyway, it talked about Israeli soldiers using microphones, and they had a refugee camp surrounded.
Fred, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're at the end of the show. You'll have, give me a call back, you know, a little later on in the week, and we can talk about this at some more length. This is not the kind of thing that we can deal with in 30 seconds. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. I'll be filling in for Randy Rhodes next.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.